Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Leadership failures damage or even destroy companies every day. A new book, The Right Leader, Selecting Executives Who Fit, details a revolutionary process for selecting executives based on years of consulting for some of America's largest corporations. This new approach will eliminate the leadership failures that plague so many companies around the world today. Our guests are the authors of that book. Nat Stoddard is chairman of Crenshaw Associates, a New York-based consulting firm specializing in career and transition management for senior executives. And Claire Wyckoff is an accomplished writer and editor who has held executive positions in both the corporate and nonprofit sectors. Welcome to Edgewise.
Thank you.
Well, let's go right to the heart of the matter. There have been so many stories about CEO failures in the news, especially recently. Is this a trend? And what are the current statistics on turnover?
It's clearly a trend, Dave. The numbers are staggering. Turnover rates back in the 90s were roughly in the 4 to 5% range.
Uh-huh.
4 or 5% of CEOs of public companies would change out every year. In the early part of this decade, in the first 4 years, the rate escalated to 10%. And 2004 through 2008, the number is averaging 15% per year. So that's a threefold increase from just a decade ago. It's unbelievable, but 64% of CEOs, the group for whom we have data, will not make their fourth anniversary in the job.
Yikes.
40% are gone within 18 months. The cost of this is huge. The tenure of sitting CEOs has dropped from 9 years on average just a decade ago to 4.8 years. The average sitting CEO of a New York Stock Exchange company wasn't in the chair at the last recession.
Ooh.
It's amazing how much churn at the top and the costs associated with that.
So much for continuity, huh?
Absolutely.
What is the cost to a company of hiring the wrong leader?
It varies, of course, depending on the size of the company. We've calculated that for small cap companies, it's between 12 and 13 million. Mid cap, 22. And large cap, close to 53. The weighted average is around 16 million. And that's just, you know, the straight costs. If you add in all of the extra costs of bringing somebody in, et cetera, and the cost to the stock if it's
right.
a public company, the total integrated cost is $14 billion.
The ripple effects are just amazing.
And I think anybody who has been through a change at the top in their organization knows the real costs are those borne by the organization, by the people in the company. It's the lack of commitment to the organization. Oh, here we go again. Here's another change. It's the loss of momentum. Initiatives people have worked on for extended period of time get stopped for no good reason or new directions are pointed out because we have a new leader. $14 billion per year for the cost of these changes is huge. But to the individual, it comes down to the lack of money to pay for mortgages or for college tuition. That's where the real cost of leadership failures is felt.
All right, Nat, so why do you think so many CEOs are failing to measure up to these expectations?
People who get these CEO jobs are highly capable, highly competent. They've dedicated their lives for the chance to run a business.
Exactly.
The complexity of the job is part of the problem. But the real problem, in my estimation, from our experience in working with executives at this level for years, comes down to the fact that they don't fit the culture.
Interesting.
They're very capable, very competent, able to run the business. But how they run the business, not what they do, but how they do it in that particular situation is their demise.
So the fact of the matter is that many times they're coming in and they're not culturally aware of the company they're entering.
Exactly. And the problem is not the CEOs. Let's face it, everything that is written about leadership is all about the leader. It's all about the shape of the peg, let's say.
Right.
Problem isn't the shape of the peg. The problem is we don't really know the shape of the hole that peg is supposed to fit. So going out and pursuing and plucking a perfectly effective, strong leader that's triangular-shaped peg in a triangular-shaped hole and trying to put that leader into our, what shape was that? Octagonal?
Right, just slide it in.
I'll tell you what, we'll pound it in. We'll grease the skids and slide it in. No matter what we do, it's not going to fit. And that's the problem. Not that they're incapable.
Sure.
It's how they go about doing things for the cultures they have to go into.
So, Claire, tell me, what's wrong with the way most companies go about selecting their leaders, especially today?
The vast majority, most companies, rely on a very traditional process in which the emphasis is almost exclusively on abilities and personality. Mm-hmm. One can see it sort of makes sense because they're much more observable, they're more measurable.
Somebody who's out
they've
there,
got
whose
the
track record is proven.
Yep.
And
mm-hmm.
Okay.
They've done it before, they've done it well. They have exactly what the people making the selection think are the right mix of abilities. But there are a lot of people, actually, when you bring in a group that are so close in that range, that there have to be other ingredients that go into it.
Exactly. I think you're absolutely right. The mistake these companies make is they tend to look out when what they should be doing is very much looking inward, thinking about the culture, and doing that extra analysis and that deeper understanding.
Yeah, because the abilities and personality actually are only addressing the needs.
Sure.
They may or may not be addressing the culture, but that's a very hit or
miss
kind
of thing. And even some of these titanic superhero CEOs, sometimes the fit is just really bad.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Nat, in the book, you describe a different way of looking at the executive selection process, and you call it the match-fit model. Now, how is the match-fit model different from a traditional executive selection process?
It provides a place, conceptually, for the things the current model doesn't really address.
Right.
We know they're there.
Okay.
We look today selecting a leader the same as we do selecting people further down the organization. As a matter of fact, it's virtually the same way that we have selected leaders and executives since World War II. Just get me a warm body and we'll put them in the job and we'll teach them how we want to have things done. This is not a good place for on-the-job training when you're hiring a CEO.
Of course not.
And things like culture, energy, character don't have a place in the traditional model. The match-fit model says, we'll stop using those two terms, match and fit, interchangeably. And we say the match is how well the individual's abilities and capabilities, knowledge, experience, all the things we can check off and measure, and all the things we interview for, how well do they align with the needs of the organization? The fit has to do with the character, the values, the beliefs, and the philosophies, those that relate to business. How well do those align with the nature of the organization,
mm-hmm.
its values, its beliefs, the things that make up its culture? So fit becomes a piece of the equation for hiring as well as match.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas today we just look at the match, we need to look at both. But we need to start with the company and define what is the shape of this company, what are the true needs, what are its real cultures like, and then go and find a leader who not only can do the job, but can do it in a way that will inspire followership in this company.
Mm-hmm. Nat, there are a lot of doubters out there, and some people don't believe that company culture is really an important consideration during the search for new leaders. You claim it's essential to their success or failure. Why is culture so important?
If you ask anybody at a cocktail party who's involved in senior decision making, they'll tell you that culture is important. What's the most important thing about your company? It's the way we do things. We're different from our competitors. This is the stuff that makes us unique. That's true. Of course, don't ask those same people how to define the term culture.
Right.
You'll get I have to go to the bar.
Okay.
Because culture has been treated for some reason like soft stuff.
That's definitely true.
I know it's important. I just don't want to get into it and try to understand it. A great analogy is quality. It used to be, how do you define quality? Well, I know it when I hear it. When somebody closes the door of a Mercedes.
The door slam, yep.
I know that sound. That's the sound of quality.
Exactly.
Ask an engineer today, what's the sound of quality? And he will answer you specifically in decibels from a certain distance with a certain moment applied to the door.
And he'll pull out the graphs and charts.
Exactly. And say, this is quality. And why did they measure it so precisely? So they can replicate it.
Right.
We don't do that with culture. Social scientists have been measuring culture for years. It's time that we step back and look at culture with the same rigor that we have looked at every other element of business. Use the same tools that drive Six Sigma, that drive Lean, in order to take a look at what's going wrong and what's driving these numbers that are so terrible about the turnover, that are so costly, that undermine the uniqueness of the company instead of leveraging it.
Right, right. Claire, culture is generally looked upon as important but intangible soft stuff, but it binds an organization. Now, is it really possible to describe or measure a corporation's culture?
Yes, exactly. Because Six Sigma came in a while ago and started to show us And there was demonstrable proof that you could manage better if you could measure what you were managing.
Absolutely.
So others started to come in, and there are other students in this field who have started to try to find ways to measure culture that, in fact, could be pretty rigorous about it.
Yeah.
We've developed a tool that is digitally based. Interestingly enough, we called on an outside firm to do the actual technical part of it. Mm-hmm. That firm is headed by a former AMA CEO.
Very interesting. Are you worried about demystifying culture?
Not in the least. That'd be like saying, are you worried about going to Bible study because you'll try to understand too much about your spirituality?
But aren't you worried about it's losing its magic?
Not in the least. The other thing that we emphasize, Dave, is that in understanding culture and using culture to make better decisions about who's going to fit in here and who's going to motivate and lead and execute decisions. It's all about business results. Mm-hmm. We don't want to lose sight of the fact that there's still a place for gut feel.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Absolutely. As a pilot, you need to trust your instruments. But a pilot without a gut feel is a passenger with a stick.
Uh-huh.
You have to have a feel for what you're doing, and there's a place for it. What we want people to do is stop flying strictly with gut feel and understand that they are in the weather.
There is an instrument panel. You should be reading it.
That's exactly right. Look at what it is. Narrow the range. You'll make better decisions and your companies will prosper. That's what it's all about.
That's very interesting because so much of this seems intangible, but you guys are making it tangible. I have another question for you, Nat. You'd prefer to have someone in the role who can fit into that culture. Now, that lends itself to somebody who might be within the company already.
Mm-hmm.
Are you putting a stronger emphasis on or making an argument for hiring from within versus hiring from without? What are your thoughts on that?
It would be nice if the statistics supported the fact that insiders outperform outside people, but that's not the case. For the first 5 years in the job, outsiders outperform insiders in terms of delivering results, in terms of stock price, in terms of every other metric that we looked at. There's something that says insiders don't have an inside track. And it comes down to the simple process that when we develop internal people, we don't look at the cultures into which they're going to go. And I say cultures because it's not just the overall company culture.
Mm-hmm.
That's important. Most insiders get that. The problem with these internal candidates is that when they have risen up through a functional area and they take on a generalist role, they don't have a broad enough understanding of the cultures they're going into. The culture of the team that they lead for the first time in their lives is made up of different people who come from different places. The culture of the team that they're on, those subcultures are the ones that usually take people out.
I've heard that referred to before as a tribal mentality,
mm-hmm.
a tribe within a larger organization
right.
that has specific orientations and attitudes.
The killer is the tribe knows within a couple of weeks or months whether that new chieftain coming in fits or doesn't fit.
Oh, yes.
If people don't share the values with the leader, and the leader doesn't share the same value set, approximately, and this is Peter Drucker talking 20 years ago, the people will not trust the leader.
Hmm.
And if they don't trust the leader, they will not follow the leader.
Mm-hmm.
Without followership, there's no leadership. So many failures are because the leaders don't share enough of the values to prompt people to say, I trust him. I will go with that person. She is one of us.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is just an observation. This myth of the universal leader, John Sculley was CEO of Pepsi, and he was the golden boy and took them to new heights. And then he made this lateral jump to being CEO of Apple Computer,
right.
The universal manager. Here was the guy who could do it. And he met with quite mixed results.
Exactly. But you put your finger on it. He could do it.
Mm-hmm.
He had all the skills, all the abilities. He just didn't fit.
Hmm.
The way he did it was not compatible with one of those cultures.
Well, that's true.
But how does Steve Jobs identify, measure, specify, articulate? How does he reduce the risk of 64% failure rate for a successor?
But he is the exception to so many rules, just in terms of the way he runs the company and the way they handle product development. It really runs counter to a lot of the other stuff that's going on out in Silicon Valley.
All the more reason for finding a successor who will keep that culture, that uniqueness that translates into product, into profit, into success for so many people.
Well, it's no wonder the stock price took a dip when he was ill.
Mm-hmm. Right?
All right. Once a company has selected the right leader, what are some things they can do to help with the transition and hopefully increase the leader's chances of success.
The most fundamental thing they can do is turn over the information about the culture and about the needs that they developed prior to selecting the individual, presuming, of course, that they've done it. That becomes the richest area for knowledge about the people, about the corporate terrain, about the way we do things here. That keeps them on track with the right things to be done and doing them in the right way. Develop a transition plan based on fact, not about how we think things go, how things are done, and allow that new leader to lead based on fact and knowledge. Second thing is recognize that the world is an incredibly complex place.
Yeah.
And the higher you go, the more difficult it is to keep all the competing priorities straight. We strongly advocate an onboarding coach be available to a CEO, not just available, but involved actively in the CEO's transition, in the plotting the plan, in the tracking of the plan, in working the plan. Not a theoretical type of person, but a former CEO who's been through the rigors,
right,
preferably from outside the industry. Why? Because a little knowledge is a dangerous thing.
Right.
You need somebody to help the leader to focus on the things that need to be done and the way they need to be done. And continuing that with an advisory provider, another CEO for the longer term, to deal with the complexities.
Right.
Having somebody else who is a pilot in the cockpit with you, even though that person may not be flying the airplane, makes a huge difference.
Well, it's a force multiplier. You've got another brain in there with you.
Exactly.
We've been speaking to Nat Stoddard and Claire Wyckoff, authors of a new book, The Right Leader, Selecting Executives Who Fit. Thank you for joining us on Edgewise today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dave.
With only an internet connection and a browser, you can tap into AMA's world-class training. The American Management Association is bringing live instructor-led training right to your desktop. AMA's new virtual seminar offering features a live virtual format that is highly interactive and very user-friendly. It's taught by the same expert, world-class faculty that run our classroom sessions, and the high-quality content has been specially engineered to run in an online format. You get real-time online interaction with your course leader and your fellow attendees. You will receive a USB headset so that you can not only listen but talk to your classmates and your instructor. So take advantage of these offerings, enhance your career journey by building your skills, and you don't have to take any time away from the office. For more information about AMA's virtual seminar offering, visit our website at www.amanet.org. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.